And welcome back to Current State. The FBI has identified a Detroit man as a homegrown Islamic State supporter who fantasized about killing local Muslim religious leaders. All this according to federal court records that were first unsealed yesterday. Robert Snell in today's Detroit News writes about an investigation into 29-year-old Detroiter Sebastian Gregerson, also known as Abdurrahman bin Mikhail, who allegedly amassed an arsenal to carry out an attack while he cheered mass killings in Paris and Orlando. Sebastian Gregerson, age 29, of Detroit. According to Mr. Snell's story, the FBI raided Gregerson's home back on July 31st and discovered an arsenal of weapons. They then got permission for the raid, or they got permission for that raid after Gregerson allegedly bought illegal grenades from an undercover FBI agent. There was a lot of weaponry recovered at Gregerson's home, including seven rifles, two AK-47s, and thousands of rounds of ammunition, according to Robert Snell, writing in today's Detroit News. Opening our show today, human trafficking. It's the fastest growing illegal activity in the world. It's a multinational, multi-billion dollar industry that exploits untold numbers of people for sexual slavery or forced labor. Its victims are male and female, old and young, immigrants and native born. The state of Michigan recognizes the growing tragedy of human trafficking. The Michigan Department of Human Health and Services has recently awarded grants to three social service organizations to combat the problem. The largest of these awards will go to the Genesis Health Foundation in Genesee County. The foundation will spend $50,000 to implement what it calls the Human Trafficking Emergency Room Hospital Pilot Program. Now, this initiative will teach personnel in the ER how to identify and treat victims of human trafficking. The task is not as straightforward as it may sound. Human trafficking is a complex, dynamic problem that can be easily hidden. I spoke with two members of the Genesee Health System. Dr. Alan Jansen is the Director of Emergency Medicine Residency, and Nicholas Evans is its Vice President of Business. I first asked Dr. Jansen how widespread human trafficking is in Michigan.
Well, that's part of the problem, Mark. Even though we know it's a huge problem, we have a really hard time of getting a handle on exactly what those numbers are. That's primarily because of a lack of education, a lack of identification, and a lack of a solid reporting system, where there's a central reporting system, I should say, where all these cases, when they're identified, actually funnel through. So that's part of the issue. We do know from estimates that there's probably about 100,000 newly enslaved people every year in the United States. That's a huge number.
Do we know much about the ages of the people being enslaved?
We have a pretty good idea. The entry age is somewhere between 12 and 16. A lot of studies suggest that it's probably in the area of the age of 14-year-olds. So very young.
And you have a unique perspective on this crisis. You're not just an emergency medicine physician, but you're also a reserve officer in the Oakland County Sheriff's Department. Can you shed any light, please, on how you've seen this tragedy from both of those angles, both as a physician and a law enforcement officer?
I certainly have a unique perspective in the fact that I, as others, have made it a personal vendetta, if you will, to get out there and spread the word. Over the last 4 years or so, I've lectured and done presentations at both the national, state, and regional level, right down to going to churches around the area when I'm invited to try to educate the community. So I have a personal interest in it to help eradicate it, help educate people to identify it. In particular, people, there's three main groups that it's really, really important that we educate. One are medical professionals, the second would be law enforcement, and the third would be those in the education system. And the reason why those three groups are so unique is that these are people that have a high potential of coming in contact with people, with victims rather, while they're actively enslaved. And so if we're trained to identify key features, if we're trained to think about it, and we can start to identify them, we're really in a unique position to help these people.
Nick Evans, I want to come to you. Did Genesis Health Foundation apply for the state grant because there is an acute human trafficking situation in Genesee County? How would you characterize the situation in Genesee County?
There is an acute situation in Genesee County, and a lot of that actually, it turns out that we are a very central recruiting ground for the recruitment of the young people that Dr. Jansen was talking about, but also we are a faith-based hospital, and part of our mission and vision is to seek to serve the underserved and those who are vulnerable in this community. And so really this came by way of that we were in the process of establishing a funding campaign for SANE, which is Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program in our ED, which we have a training site that we use as a resource for this area. And then through beginning to work with the state of Michigan, it was highlighted to us that this work was also going on and that there was an opportunity for us, if you will, to design and put in place a best practice, which is kind of our DNA of trying to be innovative in introducing new programs. So we were kind of guided to that. We applied for it, and it really was the goal was to develop, implement, and then evaluate existing hospital protocols, and then use that as a means to go forward in identifying and then treating and then connecting human trafficking victims with community resources and assisting, as Dr. Jansen said, law enforcement with being successful then in the prosecution of those who victimized and trafficked those individuals. But it was really to just engage this community even one level beyond healthcare. And that was in really meeting the needs of the vulnerable individuals in this community that are being taken advantage of or maybe taken advantage to help protect them and advocate on their behalf.
Alan Jansen, back to you. Help us understand how these young people in particular become trafficked in the first place.
Well, that's an entire hour and a half lecture, but I'll tell you, this is not some accident. This is organized. This is an organized, orchestrated business worldwide, multi-billion-dollar business. Many of these victims are identified based on their risk factors. They're recruited, actually, into this. They don't even know that it's happening, and once they figure it out, it's too late. And once you get trapped in this system, it's almost impossible for these kids to get out.
Nick Evans, Michigan now requires healthcare workers to receive training in human trafficking as part of their licensing process. This is part of a fairly new law just passed in January. What does this training consist of?
It really is going back to teaching them how to identify and to know what they're looking for. Interestingly, nationally, I think the number is about 87.7% of individuals in the human trafficking trade or those victims were through a healthcare facility of one type or another during any given year. And of those, 63% of them actually probably came through an emergency department. What is critically important to us is to really give to our staff and to both our primary care physicians as well as our specialists and other individuals working within the hospital the tools they need so that it's not just a vague happen chance they notice something, but so that they know specifically what they're looking for and are equipped then once they identify that they have the protocols in place so that they can do something to hopefully intervene in that process.
What is the most common sign?
And I would defer to Dr. Jansen on that as kind of the subject expert.
I don't really think there is a most common sign. It's a constellation of things that come together, and by being aware, you'll pick up on these things. These victims are subject to a horribly violent lifestyle. So being in tune to abusive patterns, being attuned to specific injuries, being attuned to who's with the victim when they come into the emergency department. So is it an older person? Is it somebody that's overbearing, that's answering all the questions? Noticing the psychosocial aspects of the patient themselves. Are they very submissive? Do they have poor eye contact? Do they not give information? And then identifying these folks and asking them key questions about their history. For example, substance abuse. For example, run-ins with police. Abusive injuries in the past. And really kind of drilling down and asking these questions in private with them is really key to helping to identify these potential victims.
We're talking about how Michigan healthcare facilities are training to spot and care for victims of human trafficking. Our guests are Dr. Alan Jansen, Director of Emergency Medicine Residency, and Nicholas Evans, Vice President of Business Development. Both are with Genesis Health System in Genesee County. One more for you, Dr. Jansen. We think of an emergency room as a place where you depend on the staff to give you immediate treatment and attention, sometimes in life and death situations. But I understand that a trafficker might seek out the emergency room almost as an ideal place not to draw attention. Can you explain why and how that works?
Well, it is ideal potentially for some of these abusers for all the reasons you said. First of all, it's sometimes tough to track visits. So if you go to one emergency department for one thing and then the next time you go to another one, or even the same emergency department with a different provider, it sometimes is a little more challenging to track patterns. Likewise, nobody necessarily asks you for money up front. Nobody verifies necessarily your demographic information. And as you said, emergency departments are busy places. So although all the medical providers really want to do the best they can, if you come in with a complaint that superficially seems to be rather simple, you might get that treated and nobody asks the next questions or nobody pushes a little bit more information. These are the things that we're trying to train medical professionals to do on the front end, so hopefully we can identify and provide assistance to these victims.
Well, does that mean your effort will double down on awareness raising in emergency room situations or settings?
Well, I think our awareness will, as will, and the other benefit is, of course, giving medical professionals a template by which, hey, if you see these things, maybe these are the next steps you should take.
Nick Evans, a few other hospital systems in the U.S. have pioneered human trafficking awareness. There's one in Wichita, Kansas, Via Christi. And Via Christi and Genesis are both part of what's called Ascension, the largest Catholic health system in the U.S. Via Christi has developed a four-step protocol for identifying human trafficking. Do you know much about that model? Is that something Genesis might incorporate?
Yeah, we actually have a steering committee that is going to start meeting in September when the grant becomes active. And yes, we will actually be benchmarking off Via Christi and have been speaking with their folks to help us in the development of this. And I think it's really important to highlight also that the part of the work we're doing is not proprietary to our health system or to Genesee County, but the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services really brought us into this because what the goal is really is to provide these benchmarking steps and these protocols out to every doctor's office, every urgent care, and every hospital to all implement that. And the goal really is to not provide any place where trafficked victims can be taken to be treated without the good chance that they're going to be identified. And the best way for this to take place is for us to really focus in on the individuals who are the traffickers and then to do everything we can to really try to protect the victims. Very often in these situations, as we've heard from law enforcement, sometimes specifically in the sex trade, sometimes the victims who are the individuals being put on the streets or who are being used are looked at as the criminals. And our focus really is to more be an advocate on their behalf, but really go to the root problem and take away the marketplace and just make it as difficult as we can for this even to take place in our state.
Dr. Jansen, are hospitals that suspect a victim is being trafficked, are they in a position to safely detain a suspected perpetrator?
That all depends. So, no, a perpetrator, no, and sometimes not even victims. Understand that unless a victim is identified and truly identified as a minor, you can't really hold them against their will. So that's a whole another level of a problem because many times these victims are minors, but you can't prove it. They have fake ID. They don't give you honest information. And rightfully so. They're threatened. They're rehearsed. Their stories are rehearsed before they come in to medical professionals. They distrust adults for all practical purposes. So you may not be able to detain a victim. We certainly, without being in law enforcement, can't detain a perpetrator. We can report it if we suspect it, and then that falls into the hands of law enforcement.
What about trafficking victims who are not sexually abused or manipulated? What if they're sweatshop workers, for example? I mean, their abuse might be subtler than that of the sex trade. Do similar patterns or do different patterns emerge in those circumstances?
Well, I think there are similar patterns. Certainly, the injuries may be different that you're encountering. The resources that we have for those still go through, still can be reported through the human trafficking hotline. And so that is an avenue, a quick avenue to at least get some of those folks assistance if we can identify them.
In about a month, state government will host its first ever human trafficking conference. This will be September 29th in Ann Arbor. Will Genesis Health System be a part of that conference?
Yes, we'll be attending for sure.
What will your role be?
I think our role there, and Dr. Jansen can address this too, our role will be there to learn and to use and to network in building the protocols that we're going to put in place for the project that we've been tasked with doing by the state as part of this grant. And so we are not at all pretending in any way that we're experts in this, and this is building capacity. And, you know, one of the concepts we use in healthcare a lot is called best practice, and that is where you don't kind of take that arrogant position that we're going to do it ourselves and we'll do it better. You first of all go out and find out who's excellent at it, and then incorporate everything that you can from their work, and then build upon that so that you're always moving the ball forward. So that's more or less the approach that we're taking in this.
Dr. Jansen, what do you hope will come out of this conference?
Well, I mean, the first phase, the first step to the entire problem is awareness. You know, everybody always wants to believe that this is a problem that happens overseas or in other countries. It's not. It's happening in our backyard. And awareness is the first step in helping people understand the problem, helping people understand the magnitude of the problem, and really helping the victims get to some successful answer.
We have been talking about human trafficking and what healthcare officials can do to identify and care for victims. Dr. Alan Jansen is Director of Emergency Medicine Residency, and Nicholas Evans is Vice President of Business Development. Both of them are with Genesis Health System in Genesee County. That organization is using a $50,000 state grant to combat human trafficking. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And on the way on Current State, a binational group of Great Lakes mayors wants its governors and premiers to reverse a decision to allow Waukesha, Wisconsin to draw water from Lake Michigan. We'll review that story and others coming up in our Great Lakes Month in Review with reporter-commentator Gary Wilson. Well, this past weekend, the Detroit River roared with that sound. The fastest boats in the world were on the river. HydroFest marked its 100th year of racing in Detroit. Amazing. 100 years of boat racing on the Detroit River. It's a reminder that Detroit isn't just the Motor City. Detroit's manufacturing history stretches beyond the confines of America's highways to America's waterways. In our last, in the last of our summer visits to historic sites in Detroit, Scott Pohl talks with Jack Dempsey, president of the Michigan Historical Commission, about Michigan's boat and shipbuilding heritage. Interesting.
That's right, Mark. For this conversation, we chose a spot in William Milliken State Park along the Detroit River, in the shadow of the Renaissance Center, and in view of the Windsor, Ontario skyline. And there were no hydroplanes disturbing the peace on the river that day. Jack Dempsey and I talked about how, along with cars and trucks, ships and boats are a big part of Detroit's history.
It has a long and storied history in shipbuilding. The original settlers here came because they saw the possibilities of acquiring wealth in shipbuilding here on the shore of the Detroit River, which really is a strait between several Great Lakes. Before Detroit made cars, it made stoves, and of course lumber was a big industry, salt making, salt excavation, but shipbuilding was huge because of it being here on the freshwater shore, the Detroit River, and one of the major industries that grew up here around the late 1800s, early 1900s, was building ships and boats. We're actually on the edge of a boat launching basin, I guess you'd say. It's still here, right below the new Outdoor Adventure Center that the Department of Natural Resources opened recently.
And you've told me that the building we're facing here, across the street from William Milliken State Park, boats used to be built there, and this little channel that we're standing next to is where they would launch into the water.
Yes, most people know about the Outdoor Adventure Center having been called the Globe Building, which was a manufacturing firm. But before it was that, back in the late 1860s, it was the Dry Dock Engine Works. Actually, one of the workers, the young engineers and apprentice who worked there was Henry Ford. And the engine works became part of the Detroit Shipbuilding Company, which occupied this location and manufactured boats until the late 1920s. So it's a very historic boat manufacturing location, which is very interesting since it's now a DNR site that you can come visit here on the bank of the Detroit River with this channel right in front of it, reminding you that this was where boats were made and people were employed, and it was a very major part of Detroit and Michigan's economic fabric.
It also was part of America's war history, Detroit's role in building ships that were sent to war. What can you tell me about that, Jack?
Several firms, the Detroit Shipbuilding Company, Great Lakes Engineering Works, they built cargo ships to carry war material and armaments across the Atlantic to our soldiers and allies in World War I. Smaller companies made lifeboats and workboats. So during the World War I era, this was a major factor in the Allied effort to defeat the forces of the imperial powers and make the world safe for democracy, which only lasted a few years until the next Great War. And then in World War II, as part of the Arsenal of Democracy, which again, I think most people think of how the auto industry converted car manufacturing to make tanks and planes, but the boat making industry also played a huge role in making various types of craft, from small fighting ships to the most iconic boat that we probably think of today, the PT boat, the patrol torpedo boat, like PT-109 that President John F. Kennedy was captain of during World War II. And so that kind of vessel was also constructed here along the bank of the Detroit River.
And a role in D-Day.
Yes, the Chris Craft landing craft, a boat built along these shores, was the first ashore on D-Day. So Michigan soldiers played a role that day, and certainly Michigan workers who helped construct that craft played a role in helping turn the tide of victory in favor of the Allies in World War II.
I'm talking with the president of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey, about Michigan's boat building and shipbuilding history. And this particular spot where we're standing is William Milliken State Park in the city of Detroit. Lots of development in this part of Detroit that in another year or so, it would appear, might make this a really vibrant part of the city.
It's being constructed here for a lot of reasons. One is because of its location along the River Walk, which has become very well known, I think, in Michigan. It connects the Globe Building, or the DNR Adventure Center, with the Belle Isle park that the DNR is operating and bringing back to its former glory, next to the DeQuinder Cut. So there's a lot of greenways and trails here, and this will be part of the Iron Bell Trail that's being fashioned from Detroit all the way to Ironwood in the UP as part of really branding the state, not just pure Michigan, but as the trail state. And so there's a lot of activity, a lot of people walking here today, as you can see on this beautiful summer day, and a lot of investment that's occurred as Detroit's renaissance continues to unfold.
Back to the history a little bit of shipbuilding and boat building in Michigan. We're focusing on Detroit right now, but Detroit wasn't alone in the boat building industry. Marine City comes to mind, the appropriately named, I would guess, Marine City. Other cities along, if not the Detroit River, along the Great Lakes here in southeast Michigan.
Yes, good point. The St. Clair River, Lake St. Clair, Algonac, that was also a boat building site. Other parts along the shoreline of the Lower Peninsula. On the west side of the state, on Lake Michigan, obviously there were ships, boats built there, but all along this southeastern Michigan shoreline, because of the population, its proximity, its central location, it became a huge boat manufacturing locale. And so as we think about our heritage, we should, as part of our Great Lakes experience, think about how we've long been in the shipbuilding, boat building business, and take pride in that.
Well, Jack, I hope that people who are listening to us today consider a visit to Millikan State Park here in the city of Detroit. You think of the state parks as being rustic and removed from urban America. This is an urban park, one of the early developments of a state park in an urban setting. And especially if you're able to visit on a day like we've been blessed with here today, it's a beautiful place to take a walk, see the water, spend some time along the water. Really, really outstanding work that has been done here in recent years.
It's great to see this, and it really is a pure Michigan day, a pure Michigan experience. And for those who might not come to Detroit for whatever reason, come down to this location, pay attention to our boat building, shipbuilding heritage, and experience how Detroit's coming back.
Along the shores of the Detroit River in the shadow of Detroit's Renaissance Center, I'm talking with Jack Dempsey, the president of the Michigan Historical Commission. Thank you, Jack.
My pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, we'll be seeing Rectangular at the Mica Gallery in Old Town Lansing. It's an exhibit opening this weekend exploring the durability of non-digital images. These are by photographer and journalist Hal Gould. That's coming up after the break on Current State. And you may well know by now, Donald Trump returns to Michigan this weekend. He will visit a Detroit church, the guest of Bishop Wayne Jackson. This is at Mr. Jackson's church, Great Faith Ministries International on Grand River in Detroit. Mr. Jackson and Mr. Trump will also sit down for a one-on-one interview that will involve questions whether or not Donald Trump is a racist. And Chad Livengood, writing in today's Detroit News again, he says Mr. Jackson defends the move along with the decision to invite Donald Trump onto Mr. Jackson's TV show. He apparently runs a Christian TV network, and Mr. Jackson admits he's faced backlash over the invitation. He says it's not an endorsement. It is rather engagement. There's a lot of emotions going on right now. People are upset that he's coming to Detroit, he told the Detroit News. But if we don't sit down to talk to him, we'll never know what his policies are. It's not an endorsement. It is not an endorsement. It is engagement. So let's talk. The pastor said he has several questions about Trump's plans for helping low-income blacks get better education and training opportunities, as well as the politically charged topic of the New York businessman's personal views about minorities. 11 o'clock, Donald Trump in front of the congregation at Great Faith Ministries International, Grand River in Detroit. It's Current State on WKAR, 2 months after Great Lakes governors and premiers agreed to approve Waukesha, Wisconsin's request to tap Great Lakes water. A binational group of mayors is objecting to the decision. Also, confirmation hearings are approaching for Michigan's incoming director of the Department of Environmental Quality. What are we learning about the person tapped as the state's top environmental officer? Well, at the end of every month, Current State reviews the top environmental news stories with Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson. He joins us now. Hi, Gary. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be back with you.
So just 2 months ago, we were reporting Great Lakes governors voted unanimously to approve Waukesha's request to tap into Great Lakes water, and that came after a years-long process that led to the decision. Still, Waukesha is creeping back into the news. A group of U.S. and Canadian mayors has requested a formal hearing with Great Lakes governors to object to that decision. Who is this group, and what do they want?
sure, Mark. It's not over till it's over, right?
Right.
Well, the group is by name, they're the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. As you said, it's a U.S. and Canadian group. And in the past 10 years, they've been very active in lobbying the various governments on environmental and water quality issues. They're generally well-respected, and they've been influential within their limited authority. Longtime Great Lakes executive David Ulrich, who spent a career at the U.S. EPA, leads the group, and Ulrich is also very well-respected in the Great Lakes community writ large. What they want is a formal hearing before the Compact Council. That's the governors themselves or their representatives, and they want to plead their case against the unanimous decision to grant Waukesha's request. So that's where we are.
Did these mayors weigh in during the public comment period, or are we all of a sudden hearing from them now?
No. They definitely weighed in during the public comment period. That's what's a little bit curious about this. They submitted formal comments to the governors opposing Waukesha's request. And even prior to that, over the years, they've been very vocal publicly, and I mean for years, in opposing the Waukesha request. But their objections were considered in detail by the governors and rejected, but they're not giving up.
Do they have anything new?
Nope, not so far. I talked with Pete Johnson yesterday from the Council of Great Lakes Governors. They're the secretariat for the Great Lakes Compact, and they administer provisions of it. And Johnson told me that the mayors have promised to submit information in writing that will serve as the basis for the request for a hearing. But Johnson said he has yet to receive anything. He does expect to get something in the coming weeks.
Any other response from the governor's representatives, though?
Well, the governors, they're being very cautious since this hearing request for a hearing could well be a precursor to a lawsuit. So they're being very cautious in what they say, and they declined to answer my questions about whether the mayors have what's known as a legal standing to bring a lawsuit. That is, are they entitled at the law to bring in a suit? Are they an aggrieved party? So they're being very cautious in what they say.
I mean, the mayors have also gone so far as to appeal to President Obama and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to intervene. What are the chances of that?
That's puzzling to me. Likely none. Dave Nafsker, who heads the Council of Great Lakes Governors, told me there's likely no basis for them to appeal to either President Obama or Prime Minister Trudeau. And honestly, it makes the mayor's request look a little bit amateurish. You know, the Great Lakes Compact is codified in U.S. law, and it's an agreement between the eight Great Lakes states, period. So that request to Obama and Trudeau is either grandstanding, and I hope not, or lacks a basic knowledge of the law. Either way, you know, this mayor's group has been a good one over the years, but this hurts their credibility.
Hmm.
And I'd add that the mayor's also made a similar appeal to the International Joint Commission. That's the U.S.-Canadian body that advises the two governments on trans-border water issues, and that group also has no authority in this matter.
So in the end, Gary, you've been covering Waukesha for about a decade. What's your take on the mayor's challenge? Does it have legs?
Well, that's a legal question, Mark, but as a practical matter, I don't think so. Their arguments were considered ad nauseum by the governors, and I mean they were studied, dissected, debated in public for months, if not longer. So the mayors, in my opinion, are being responsible. And here's why I say that. It's telling that within this community of mayors, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett abstained from the internal vote to request a hearing. And he cited a desire to keep the issue out of the courts. Now, I've been following Barrett's career for a long time, and he's one of the most highly regarded mayors in the Great Lakes region. And he originally opposed the Waukesha decision, the Waukesha diversion. But Barrett has the wisdom to see that the greater good of what the Great Lakes Compact brings for the region, that's important. And he wants to keep it out of the courts. And I'd add that that's a similar position to Governor Snyder's thinking on the Waukesha issue. The governor told me back in the spring that the worst outcome would be for Waukesha to end up in a legal fight. And I'd add that Barrett and Snyder are at opposite ends of the political spectrum.
Interesting. Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson is our guest. Once every month, we visit with Gary about the month's top environmental news stories. Former British Petroleum executive Heidi Grether was appointed in July by Governor Snyder to head the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, replacing interim director Keith Cray. This is a critical appointment given that MDEQ's been in the spotlight for its handling of Flint and that it's oversees the Enbridge Straits of Mackinac pipeline. When we talked with you about Ms. Grether last month and about this appointment, not much was known about her, as she hadn't made any public statements. Have we learned anything more about her priorities since you and I last spoke?
Well, we have a little bit. Since we last spoke, she has talked to the media formally. And what's notable is about that is what she won't be doing. She's not going to be involved with Flint's ongoing recovery. That's going to remain with Keith Cray, who, as you said, was the interim director at DEQ, and he's since returned to head the DNR. But because of the relationships he's developed and the work that he's done, he's going to keep responsibility for Flint. And Grether also quickly, too quickly, some would say, adopted the existing Snyder administration position on Enbridge's Straits of Mackinac pipeline. That position is that it's premature to call for its shutdown until two studies of it are completed, and that's going to be well into next year. What she did say she'll focus on is culture change at the DEQ and working on the external public perception of the agency. Those are good things to do, but is that the most important job for an agency executive to be focused on?
Culture change. Well, with Flint and the Enbridge pipeline out of the picture, as you put it, what does that leave her with besides culture change?
Well, there is one big topic that's on her desk right now, and it relates to water quality in the western basin of Lake Erie. Think the cause of the Toledo water crisis, which was agricultural runoff that fueled the dangerous algae bloom. It's also about the outflow of pollutants from the Detroit River into Lake Erie. So the question on the table is, should Michigan and Ohio a request of the U.S. EPA that Lake Erie be declared impaired. Now, impaired is an official designation that would allow for tougher regulation under the Clean Water Act, and both Michigan and Ohio have been reluctant to call for that impaired designation because they don't want to end it. It could mean more regulations on farmers, and they're loath to do that. But the water quality isn't getting any better. Now, so what Grether has said is that she'll make her recommendation to the EPA, and I'm quoting here soon. That'll be the first test of her environmental leadings, and some would say whether the MDEQ can actually change stripes post-Flint.
Environmental groups were initially skeptical about Governor Snyder's selection of a former oil company executive to run MDEQ. Has any of that skepticism abated?
No, Mark, it hasn't. Her right out of the chute statement on the Straits of Mackinac pipeline was a no sale with environmental groups and even some elected officials. It appears she made a hasty determination there, to the point that U.S. Representative Candace Miller wrote to Grether saying that Grether's pipeline position was, and I'm quoting, short-sighted. And Miller asked her to use the gravitas of her office and to lead on the pipeline issue.
What's Governor Snyder's reaction been to this criticism?
Well, Mark, you know the Michigan governor very well. He's a positive guy, right? So the governor touted her qualifications, as you would expect, and he asked the doubters to give her time and to work with her. But that's a tough sale. The issues that she has inherited have been brewing for some time. And people's patience to wait for substantive action has just worn thin, and they've definitely worn thin with the MDEQ in general. There's no transition period here for Grether, given what's happened at MDEQ. That's what she's up against.
August is traditionally a slow month for political and policy activity on Great Lakes issues, but things pick up in September. What's on the horizon with the various groups here that impact water policy?
Well, September and October is the traditional time when the various official groups in the Great Lakes region that work on Great Lakes issues meet for their annual conferences. Like I said, those will take place in September and October. You know, officially, they'll continue to work on the policy work of day-to-day trying to improve the Great Lakes. But unofficially, the cocktail party buzz is going to be what happens when the federal government changes in January. That's the backstory.
We want to thank Gary Wilson, our monthly environmental news journalist and commentator here. He joins us at the end of every month to review what's happened in that month. Gary, thank you very much.
Always good to be with you. See you next month, Mark.
And don't forget, Current State discusses Michigan's environment every Tuesday. Our segments and others about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and at wkar.org. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A new exhibit about to open at the Mica Gallery in Old Town is called Seeing Rectangular. It opens this weekend. It explores the durability of non-digital images by photographer and journalist Hal Gould. Jamie Paisley of Current State has more.
In the words of photographer Hal Gould, this year more photos were taken than any year in history. Last year was a record year, and next year will likely be a new record. Digital images meant for sharing, but not for hard copies. So for his new exhibit opening this weekend in Old Town Lansing's Mica Gallery, Hal Gould focused on providing long-term durability in the print and paper, which theoretically can last indefinitely. As for the captured images themselves, well, the Mica Gallery director, Katrina Daniels, looks to Hal Gould's background as both a photographer and a journalist.
So he really looks at photography a little bit different. He spent most of his years traveling, looking at photo essays, and sort of thinking about images and what story that they would tell. So he didn't really look at it as much as how will this hang in a gallery, but really what story will this tell? And he's just done a number of photo essays that are based on people, portrait work. But I love his work because it isn't just about making this person beautiful or glamorous. It's really looking at different subcultures and taking photographs of an individual or a few people and then telling a story with that.
And the new exhibit that's coming up, Seeing Rectangular, that the subjects seem to be fairly transient, or at least not frequently glimpsed upon.
Yeah, that's a really good point that you noticed that, absolutely. I mean, we're going to be looking at musicians that were traveling through the Lansing area, famous musicians such as Willie Dixon, an old blues legend, but also looking at nuns, women in strip clubs, border patrol, and even individuals, squatters, who were living sort of on the Mexican border when Hal was there. So we're going to see a wide variety of images and a wide variety of stories, but this is really where Hal comes at it from a storyteller through his photojournalist background.
And even if I remember correctly, a retirement community that's right outside of Detroit also makes a bit of an appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's this wonderful image of this sort of young woman who has MTV on in the background, and then this older lady in the retirement community sort of sitting there, doesn't seem to be really understanding her, you know, her surroundings. But this disjunction between the two is really fascinating. And I love that Hal goes in and he just captures these moments that say so much with this one image. And you can just imagine a whole lifetime, you know, of information around that.
The main image that you have currently, at least, on the Mica page or the mm-hmm. Facebook page is one musician, but it's very, very close up. It's an extreme close up. Mm-hmm. But from what you're saying, there's a variety of approaches that Hal has made with these photographs.
Yeah, there's or sort of looking at this from more of a landscape perspective, also close-up portraits. Hal really, like I said, is a storyteller, so he really looks at these differently. One of the reasons why we did use the Willie Dixon image is because this is actually going to coincide with the Blues Fest, which is one of our programs that we produce here. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was creating that connectivity between, you know, one of these programs that we produce and the gallery as well. So, you know, the viewers will be able to see a variety of stories from these different essays. But for those blues fans, this is, you know, a legend that passed through our own community.
We're speaking with Katrina Daniels of the MICA Gallery about the upcoming Seeing Rectangular exhibit of the photographer Hal Gould. And the opening night is actually coinciding with something rather recurring that happens here in Old Town. What is that event?
That is the Arts Night Out, and this is something, it's sort of a baby of mine. I've been working with the Arts Council for about 2 years to make this happen. So what happens is all of the businesses and galleries open their doors, stay open a little bit longer, bring in artists, creatives, often have refreshments available. This is free to the community. You can come out and experience Old Town, maybe go into businesses that you weren't normally able to go into, like a graphic design firm, something like that. They'll open their doors and bring artists in. We'll also see, you know, people busking out on the streets and just really fun things like that. It's very, very vibrant. And of course, Hal will be here the whole time, so that he's such a wonderful person to speak with. And he just has so much passion and he's just this really, really great storyteller. So he's going to be here. He's really excited about meeting all the guests and talking about his work as well.
There is, in addition, there's a lot of Michigan connections also. We talked about the retirement community that's mm-hmm. outside of Detroit, but some of the musicians, they would have more passing through connections, mm-hmm. like they were coming through and then Hal would photograph them. Could you tell us about mm-hmm. that?
Sure. So a lot of people may not realize that for a long time, East Lansing and Lansing were really bringing in some pretty substantial musical acts. And there used to be just a few small little bars where these huge names would come through. And since Hal was working here as a photojournalist, he had these opportunities, you know, to meet with these musicians and capture them. And I think it can be hard to imagine these just legendary musicians actually coming through and playing at, you know, these tiny little bars, but there was actually that was really prominent for quite a while, and so Hal captured them, and we'll be able to kind of see, you know, see these musicians that left a mark on Lansing.
And there's also the connection to not just musicians, but of that transient type, or the not frequently seen. There's also the subjects of the upcoming Hal Gould exhibit, right, Seeing Rectangular. The prison population also has a bit of a focus in Hal's exhibit.
Yes, he has this one image of this man who is standing facing the camera with his hands out, and he is actually a resident of a prison, so he actually isn't there. He's in there. He's there on his own accord. It's absolutely fascinating because he is extremely dangerous, and Hal really wanted to be able to go in and sort of, you know, talk to these prisoners and get this idea of what their life is like. And apparently, this man had served his time. He legally was allowed to leave, and he just wasn't comfortable in the outside world. So he actually came back to the prison and lives there and can leave at any time. Apparently, he's a very dangerous man. Hal said he was quite nervous to be able to actually walk into this tiny little cell and photograph him. But I mean, what a story. Somebody who actually walked back into the prison and said, you know, I choose to stay here. But I love that those are the types of stories that Hal picks out, these like transient kind of populations, these subcultures that maybe we wouldn't normally talk about or have access to.
And you can see Hal and meet Hal and hear these very different stories of mm-hmm. the photographs coming up for his new exhibit coming at the MICA Gallery. Opening night is September 2nd. It runs mm-hmm. through October, the MICA Gallery in Old Town. More information about the exhibit, Seeing Rectangular, you can find online at micagallery.org. Katrina, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we recap Michigan's top political stories from August, from the pot petition to the primaries to the Donald in Diamonddale. There was a lot going on in our state. We'll review those events with State Capitol Senior Correspondent Tim Skubick, host of Off the Record on WKAR-TV, and MLive Capitol reporter Emily Lawler. Plus, it's always appropriate to generate enthusiasm for the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. At least that's how iTech sees it. The Information Technology Empowerment Center offers programs that teach technological skills and build confidence for students from middle school up to adulthood. For Neighbors in Action, we'll check in with iTech's Executive Director Kirk Riley and Nancy Lubeski, Principal of Wexford Montessori Academy in Lansing, to find out more about their programs. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, at KAR Current State. Check us out on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. See you tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.